The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.
Good afternoon, Trinidad and Tobago. It's just 6 minutes after the hour of 12 noon today. Davey Murray is my name. I'm at the helm of the chair this afternoon, as I get set to go straight into the lunchtime doctor with Dr. Brittany Dean. Brittany, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Davey, and it is great to have you back on the Lunchtime Doctor. Yeah, and of course, good afternoon to all our listeners out there.
It's been a minute since you and I actually worked together and pioneering one of these projects. So I look forward to a very spirited and animated discussion with you this afternoon as we get through the many health questions that will be coming from persons today. We encourage persons at 625-2257 and 627-3223. Send your messages to 306-1065. And any questions you have for the doctor, please bear in mind. I don't know if Bayes does do this, but I will tell you guys straight up out of the, as we begin the show, is that the doc will give you information based on the info that you provide. Remember, she doesn't have your medical file. She doesn't know your medical history. So she will do the best she can in terms of her recommendations to answer your questions based on the info you provide. All right? I think I should put that disclaimer out there. So you can't call back and say, well, the doctor meant to do this and it didn't work. Remember, she doesn't have all the information about your health history and all those things. So with that being said, we do our best on the program with Bayes and Dr. Brittany Dean to really give you guys comprehensive insight to health and healthcare in this country and what you can do to improve your health, or even if you're having health challenges at this time, what can be recommended. And in some instances, I've heard the doctor say, go visit your doctor, get to the hospital where your history can be reviewed and you can get comprehensive help. With that being said, Dr. Dean, how are you?
I am doing fantastic. And I mean, it's the last Lunchtime Doctor for the week, but it is always a very interesting one. It's always an interesting medical topic. And, you know, just putting it out there that while we may be discussing something in particular, mm-hmm. anybody can call in with any of their medical questions.
Well, I want to start off with one. I mean, we always have those things, and there's something that I must say I want an answer to. Now, I don't suffer with migraines. I have heard of persons who suffer with migraines, and when they suffer with migraine headache, it's like, you know, I don't know how it feels. I can't say. But I do have headaches. I have experienced it from time to time. So my first question before we take, well, we actually have a call on the line. Let's see who is there. Hello, good afternoon.
I have a question for the doc. Exercise, right? You have a nice exercise and you're exercising, but all of a sudden you're losing plenty of weight. Your clothes are fitting you, you're looking, you know, going through, and after you're like, you know, you're all that weight now, you know, you're looking small, you're getting small. So is to continue exercising or relax a little bit, or tell me what to do.
All right, that's the first question.
So this is a very good observation. And the thing with exercise, we tend to neglect the part that happens outside of the gym or outside of the working out, and that is the proper diet, the proper balanced meals that you are supposed to be having. So if you're exercising, your appetite is going to increase. Now, if you're doing specific types of exercise, for example, resistance training or, you know, muscle building exercises, you definitely want to increase your protein intake so that you can maintain that muscle mass that you are building. But some people, they tend to think that exercise alone is going to make them healthy or going to give them the results that they want. But no, it's a combination of both exercise and having a proper balanced diet. And the thing about exercise and even eating a balanced diet, you should not associate it only with losing weight. It should be associated with a healthy lifestyle. So what we would usually recommend for a healthy lifestyle would be something like 150 minutes of moderate intensity activity for the week. So you split that up into 30 minutes, five times a week. And that could be things like cycling or swimming or running, whatever you like to do, just ensure that your heart rate is elevated for that 30 minutes every day so that you can get the proper heart health benefits. Now, if you are exercising and you find that you are losing weight rapidly, it could be, like I said, just you are not supplementing it with your diet enough, or it could be a metabolic issue that is going on. And in that case, you're going to have to go and get it checked out. And yesterday we talked a little bit about unintentional weight loss. That means people who are not even exercising or dieting towards weight loss, but they are experiencing weight loss. And we talked about the different causes for that. So in that case, those things need to be evaluated by your doctor. But you should not stop exercising just because you think that you are getting a little smaller and you can't fit into your clothes. You should definitely be supplementing it properly with a proper balanced diet that is tailored towards the exercise that you are doing for your particular body goals.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. I hope that answers your question. So tell me, what exactly is a headache and how it does it occur in one's body?
So a headache really is something that I'm very sure at least 99.9% of the world's population is going to experience at some point in their life. And the thing about a headache is that we tend to think it is a disease, but it's actually a symptom and not a disease itself. And really and truly, it refers to that pain or the discomfort that we may experience in our head, our scalp, our neck, and even our blood vessels, the nerves, the muscles, and the membranes that are surrounding the brain. All of these things are responsible for generating this headache pain. And when these structures become inflamed or irritated or stressed in any way, they are going to send signals to the brain that is going to be interpreted as pain. And the brain tissue itself, like our brain itself, cannot actually feel pain, but the discomfort actually arises from these surrounding structures. So the muscles, the nerves, the tissue surrounding the brain itself. And people don't know that headaches can actually be categorized. So it can either be primary, meaning that it's not caused by any other disease. And we see this in migraines or tension type headaches. Or it can be secondary, meaning that some disease process is causing the headache as a symptom. So if people have sinus issues, or if they have high blood pressure or a brain tumor, that can actually lead to a headache. And most people will experience primary headaches throughout their life, which are often not very serious, but it can significantly affect a person's quality of life and, of course, performing their daily tasks. So it is important that we understand this distinction, because that is going to determine whether a headache is going to require immediate medical attention or if it can be managed at home.
Well, you haven't. I'm not satisfied 100, and I'll tell you why. Mm-hmm. You have just described different types, but when your head hurts, what exactly is hurting?
So, again, this is going to be dependent on the structure that is involved. So, for example, if somebody pulled a muscle in their neck, then that muscle is probably a muscle pain that is radiating to the head, and that can cause a headache. If a nerve becomes inflamed, then that can also cause a headache, especially if it's one of the cranial nerves itself. Now, if the meninges, and we've heard about something called meningitis, the meninges are actually tissue that surrounds the brain itself. When those become inflamed, then that can also lead to a headache. So whichever structure is involved, and if that structure becomes stressed or inflamed or, you know, get some sort of infection, that can lead to a headache. Some headaches are actually idiopathic, meaning that some people just get a headache for no reason at all as well.
Idiopathic? How do you get a headache for no reason? Is it that you're saying you have a headache, you're thinking your head hurts, but it's not?
So what I mean by that is that if you have a stressor in your daily life, For example, you have not hit your head. You have not done something to irritate a nerve or a muscle or any sort of tissue that is surrounding the brain or the cranium itself. But you are just stressed out because you have a lot of work to do, or you've had some sort of trigger, meaning it could be either some sort of breakup or some sort of grievance that occurs, that emotional stress can trigger a headache without having any structures involved, because you're increasing cortisol in the body, and that cortisol causes inflammation in every part of the body, which can also include your head, without having any particular structure involved, if you understand what I mean.
All right, so I do get that. But sometimes when you do take a Panadol or some painkiller, often the headache goes. Is it that the whatever structure has been damaged, is it that has been repaired? What happens when you take this painkiller? Because if it is so damning that this structure is causing the pain and you take the painkiller, all right, does the painkiller repair the pain? Because after a while, the painkiller kicks in, the pain goes. When that medication subsides from your body, the pain should reoccur or should come back. If it's not, does the painkiller repair these nerves or these damaged infrastructure within the head? Does that happen?
So what tends to happen is that you can have inflammation of these structures, which can subside by itself without even the painkillers, etc. But what happens when we take something like, say, a Panadol or a paracetamol? It actually works in several ways. So Panadol works primarily in our central nervous system, which is our brain and spinal cord. And what it does is that it actually blocks the pain signals itself. So it inhibits a certain enzyme, especially in the brain. And that enzyme actually helps to produce something called prostaglandins, which cause or that signals the pain and the inflammation. And by reducing those prostaglandins, then you sort of raise your pain threshold. So you feel less discomfort from the headache. So you're not actually repairing the tissue itself. You're sort of masking the pain with the Panadol. But over time, especially if it's not something very serious, then that tissue will sort of replenish or repair itself, especially if you're taking, if it's a nerve pain and if you're taking B12, etc. That will repair itself. Our body is very resilient. So if it's not something very serious, that will sort of repair or replenish itself over time. But the Panadol and these pain medication, what it essentially does is just masks the pain, or it blocks the pain and raises our own pain threshold. So while the pain is still technically there, it is less discomfort we are going to feel because we have less prostaglandins in the system.
All right, I understand that, and I thank you very much for that explanation. 625-2257 and 627-3223, these are the numbers you can call me on.
Good afternoon, Livy. Nice to hear you. Good afternoon, Doctor. My question is, if someone has a good lipid panel and a good A1C, or is not even diabetic, and yet he gets a sudden heart attack in his 40s or 50s, what is the mechanism that triggers that heart attack, and what can be done to prevent it? Thank you.
All right.
So the thing about a heart attack, remember that there are several different risk factors for a heart attack. So atherosclerosis is definitely one. Having a good lipid panel probably suggests that this person does not have high cholesterol. Diabetes is also one. So having a good HbA1c suggests that this person may not have diabetes. But high blood pressure is also a factor that we have to consider. Being a smoker, even without having any of these comorbidities, is also a factor that we have to consider. And even just aging, because as you age, what tends to happen is that your arteries are going to become stiffer and less resilient. So just aging by itself is another factor that we have to look at. for coronary artery disease, which can also lead to a heart attack. So even if you have a good lipid panel and a healthy HbA1c, you can still have a heart attack. And we haven't even mentioned things like the genetic risks. Having a family history of early heart disease can also raise a person's risk significantly, and even chronic stress as well, because again, that increases cortisol and adrenaline, and those by itself can raise your blood pressure and trigger spasms within the heart and increase clot formations, which can lead to a heart attack. Now, the things that you have to look at in your life to ensure that you are healthy and to ensure that you are not putting yourself on that pathway to get a heart attack is the same things that we tell every single person: having a proper diet, a well-balanced diet that is rich in your whole grains, that is rich in your anti-inflammatories, like your omega-3 fatty acids, rich in your green leafy vegetables and your antioxidants as well. And on top of that, your proper exercise protocols on a daily basis. We tend to think that we only need to exercise when we have been diagnosed with something or if we're trying to lose weight. No, exercise actually is definitely one of the major things that we look at when somebody has had a heart attack without any other risk factors, because living a sedentary lifestyle, having that lack of regular exercise, weakens your cardiovascular resilience, even if your weight is fine and even if your labs look fine as well.
All right, let's take a call coming in. Hello, good afternoon. Hello.
Hi, good day.
Good day.
Is this the sunshine doctor?
Yes, it is.
I had a, what do you call it, a surgery, right? And the doctor took off the stitches, and then they took off the plaster, so they tell me no more plaster. But right now, I'm getting a pain right on top of the which one the cut was.
Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, you're getting a pain on top where the cut was, and they removed the stitches.
Uh-huh. They removed the stitches, and I was going in the clinic for it to dress it. And then they stopped the dressing because they said, oh, I don't need no more dressing because it cured good. But last night and the night before, I was getting pain. I take some Panadol, right? And right now, right where the cut is, you know. But you know, there's cutting from your chest going down almost to your navel. Right, but at the top of that one was hurting.
So can be is residual inflammation from having the surgery. So sometimes even weeks after having a surgery, some people can still feel that pain, especially in the area where they've been cut or where they've made certain incisions. Now, the important thing to note is make sure that when you're experiencing the pain, if the pain is very harsh, for example, it's a 10 out of 10 pain, you definitely need to go and get it checked out. If it is a mild pain that can easily be managed at home, more than likely, it's not something that is extremely serious. It is probably just that residual inflammation that I was talking about. But if you experience any sort of bleeding from the wound, if you experience any sort of discharge from the wound, and if you have seen any sort of opening in the wound itself, you definitely need to go and get it checked out. Also, if you're experiencing any fever, any nausea or vomiting, any chills or any other symptoms that are not in line with what you feel on a daily basis, make sure and you go and get it checked out as well. Like I said, it could be something very benign. It could be just that residual pain that people do experience weeks after their surgery. Some people even experience it months after their surgery, and it It is just that buildup of scar tissue right under the cut itself. But if you experience any of the red flags that I just spoke about, please go and get it checked out.
All right. With that being said, let's take this one.
Good afternoon, Davey, and good afternoon, Doc. Sometime before I get a headache, like a day before, 2 days before, I get little bubbles of air popping out from my ears. And that's an indication that a headache is going to attack me. Now, when I do get the migraine headache, Doc, what helps relieve the migraine headache is to vomit. Could you explain why the vomiting relieves the headache within like a half an hour time? What is the medical explanation for that? That only when I get the migraine headache and I vomit, it dies down within a half an hour time. Thanks, I'm listening off air.
All right.
So that is a very good observation by that person. And I would say that for some people, because I've had patients who said that the vomiting does help to relieve their migraines as well, the mechanism is not fully understood. But what we believe is that migraines themselves may involve the abnormal activation of what we call the trigeminal nerve and certain brainstem pathways that control pain and nausea and gut functioning as well. So you'll find that a lot of people who have migraines, they tend to feel very nauseous, and they may even describe they have some sort of aura prior to having that migraine. So how this person said that the day before their ears will be popping, each person can have an individualized aura. Some people will see flashing lights. Some people will see bubbles in the air. There are many different things. Vomiting itself helps to stimulate a certain nerve, and that helps to reset your entire system and dampen those pain signals. So for some people, it leads to relief. And vomiting itself, it alters your brain chemistry and certain brain chemicals like serotonin, and that plays a very key role in migraines. So even some migraine medications also work by adjusting these serotonin levels, and vomiting may naturally mimic that effect itself. So the full mechanism is not fully understood by medicine and science yet, but it just really is about resetting that nervous system and, of course, relieving any pressure that that person may have pent up in that trigeminal nerve.
You know, with that being said, I think this time we're going to take our next call, but I think this one is urgent. Hi, Dr. Dean. I'm a diabetic for 22 years. I had open heart surgery in 2019. Now my BP is 163 over 131. All right, the blood pressure is 163 over 131. The pulse is 71. I feel like someone's standing on my chest. I feel like I can't catch my breath. And I am low glycemic. I'm on a low glycemic diet as well.
So, first of all, I definitely think that if you are not on any antihypertensive medications or anything like that, you definitely please go and get yourself evaluated by a doctor, preferably the doctor who knows your medical history, so they will know how to tailor your management to you. And especially in Spain, with that blood pressure and you're a diabetic, those are two main risk factors for a heart attack. I know that you said that you had open heart surgery already, but you can still experience another heart attack after having open heart surgery. So I definitely suggest that you go as urgently as possible, go and get yourself evaluated by your doctor.
All right. With that being said, let's take a phone call. Hello, good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon, Davey. Good afternoon, Doc. I have a question that I'm not too certain about. I am diabetic. I was on a particular product called Jardiance, 10 milligrams. My sugar level has never elevated to more than 120. But when I went back to my doctor, because my cholesterol is 167 and my A1C was 6.1, yet they increased the afternoon medication from 10 to 25, and I noticed a significant weight loss after that takes place. I don't feel sick. I never had the experience of low blood sugar. I'm very, very active, you know. So I don't know what's the reason for that unaccounted loss. When I asked my family doctor, he said that is one of the products that actually does weight loss. So I don't know. I'll listen off to you.
So, yes, Jadians is under something called an SGL2 inhibitor. And that basically causes your kidneys to excrete any sort of excess sugar into your urine. And that is going to lead to a loss of calories. So that is why it does contribute to the weight loss. And that is why you may have also been experiencing weight loss. And some of these popular weight loss drugs these days are actually of the same class of drug. So to answer your question, yes, Jadians does lead to weight loss.
All right, let's take another call. Hello, good afternoon.
Hello, good afternoon. Doctor, I'm getting this empty headache, and that does give me a warning that the fit is about to come. What's it causing that?
Could you repeat the question? I didn't hear it properly.
I didn't hear him properly either. Nick, phone call cut off. 625-2257 and 627-3223. Could you call us back and give us the question? We didn't get the question quite clear. Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Yes, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Murray. Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Doc.
Good afternoon.
Doc, I'm 67 years old. I retired as a ship worker, right?
Mm-hmm.
Real problem in sleeping in the night because 2 years now I'm off the job against pension. So Doc, I start using sleeping tablets at times. No special alcohol way. When I drink a punch, I just sleep too bad. Now I realize I come an alcoholic, you know what I mean? So Doc, any recommendation? Thank you very much. Murray, you should continue. You cut your contribution in the beginning of the program. I want to hear yours, Murray.
All right, thank you very much.
So we do find, unfortunately, people do resort to alcohol when they do have sleeping issues. Now, sleeping issues or insomnia, it can be due to several different things. It could be due to certain medical conditions. It could be due to certain stresses in the life. And if we don't get down to what the root cause of the problem is, it's very difficult for us to tailor medical management to that person. This person said they were taking sleeping tablets before, but sometimes it's something as simple as their sleep schedule itself and creating a sleep-friendly environment. Maybe an hour or two before this person was going to sleep, they have been doing some high-intensity activities or they've been watching TV or scrolling on their phone. And we tend to neglect the very simple things or the simple changes that we can make in our daily life that will help to improve our quality of health and our quality of sleep as well. And I definitely suggest that if you do think that you are getting a problem drinking the alcohol, you should go to the hospital and join one of our clinics. We do have clinics that are catered to alcoholics. We have support groups that are catered to alcoholics as well. And once we have helped to fix that problem, we can then look at why this person is not getting enough sleep, why they're experiencing insomnia. And he did mention something important. Shift work does tend to mess with sleeping patterns. And this is where simple procedures like establishing a sleep schedule, creating a sleep-friendly environment, watching what you eat and drink, especially around that time to sleep, avoiding caffeine, limiting alcohol, because alcohol may make you sleepy at first, but it is going to disrupt your quality of sleep. So this person may be falling asleep, but their quality of sleep is not going to be good. And winding down before your bed, your bedtime as well, turning off all screens an hour before bed, trying certain calming activities, and even trying over-the-counter of vitamins like magnesium glycinate or melatonin or even chamomile tea as an alternative to alcohol and prescription sleeping tablets, because even I, as a doctor, don't like to prescribe sleeping tablets to people, because you become dependent on these things as opposed to looking for a sustainable way to have proper quality sleep and also falling asleep properly as well.
Well, when I'm having problems, I use sleep aid, and I knock out within 10, 15, I feel the effects and I go and sleep. But I want to ask you, I heard the recommendation about turning off the devices an hour before. Doc, do you turn off everything an hour before you fall asleep?
I actually do turn off, I wouldn't say like an hour, maybe about 45, 30 minutes, because to fall asleep, what I would do is read a book. And that has helped me fall asleep, because I, working in the hospital is also a shift system.
Mm-hmm.
And your quality of sleep as a doctor, and I will boldly say this, it is very poor. And even your sleep schedule is going to be messed up. So coming out of the hospital, I had to establish a certain sleep schedule. I had to find what works for me and for my quality of sleep. And for me, I would take magnesium glycinate before going to bed. I would drink a cup of chamomile tea, and I would read a book at least 30 minutes before going to bed. And that helps me wind down for the night. It helps me fall asleep. And another thing that I would suggest is do not have a TV in your room.
What?
My room does not have a TV at all.
I would because then.
That you would be surprised. A lot of patients, that is the reason they cannot fall asleep, because the TV screen, all of these things emit blue light, and even your tablets and even your phone screens, and that tends to suppress your internal melatonin. So you will find that it is much harder for you to fall asleep if you've been watching a screen.
What I do realize is that if it is, I take off the television, I get a better sleep somewhat. But most times I jump up, I might put it back on, or, you know, but what? No TV? Nah, boy. Doc, I wouldn't survive. Sorry about that. Good day. One person is saying, good afternoon, doctor. Can you recommend to boost your immune system? I eat relatively well and exercise. My sleep isn't the best. I have two young kids, but I found of late, whenever my kids get sick, I get sick as well. And it takes a long time for me to get over it.
So let me tell you something about children. Children are very resilient and they can bounce back like nothing. But as you get older, remember, your immune system, yes, our immune system is very robust, but it can also take a hit. And we tend to have more stress. We tend to have cortisol within our system, possibly on a daily basis. And all of these things tend to shoot down your immune system. But when I was working in pediatrics, I swear every month you're probably going to get the cold, because children are going to come in, they're going to be very sick, and you are just going to be getting sick and sicker and sicker. And we can be very resilient to it, but it is also about, like this person said, boosting your immune system.
But and could parents take something? Because she says she has two, this person said, I have two young kids, and every time the kids get sick, them sick.
Yes. Well, for parents, you can take a multivitamin. They tend to have more than your daily recommended amount of vitamins in it. So taking a multivitamin is good on a daily basis, but there are also immune boosting foods that you should have on hand. So your citrus fruits, things that are high in vitamin C, like your oranges, your grapefruit, your limes, your lemons, all of these things increase your white blood cell production. And your white blood cells are the ones that fight off the viruses and the bacteria and all the pathogens. And vitamin C is not stored in the body. It's important for people to know that. So you can't just stock up on about 5 oranges a day and think that you're not going to get sick. Yes, you can drink your vitamin C and that will help to boost your immune system. But when you are sick as well, you should be still consuming vitamin C because at that point, it is going to be most beneficial. Garlic as well. It contains antimicrobial compounds, so use it in your soups, in your stews, in raw, in your dressings. Ginger, so taking ginger and turmeric shots, some people like to do that. That reduces inflammation, so add it to your tea or your smoothies. And, of course, your green leafy vegetables. We tend to gloss over our vegetables, but they contain essential vitamins like A, C, E, antioxidants, your nuts, your seeds, all the antioxidants that you need, you will get in this. And eating a proper balanced diet on a daily basis will help to boost your immune system. But what's not helping to boost your immune system, and in fact, bashing it a lot more, is the refined carbohydrates that we like to consume that is in your white breads and your pastas and your pastries. And of course, excess sugar causes inflammation in the body, and that as well is shooting down your immune system. So you definitely need your essential vitamins, your vitamin C and D and zinc. All of these things help to fight infections, which you can get from your multivitamins, or you can also get it from your food. But I would always suggest to get your vitamins from your foods because it is superior than taking just a multivitamin alone.
All right. Thank you very much for clearing that up. Hello. Good afternoon. Hello.
Yes. Hello.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Yes. I'm telling you that I'm getting the headache as a warning when before I get the epilepsy. What causes that?
Okay.
So this person states that they have epilepsy. I didn't hear that in the first one. But for certain people, they will get an aura before they have an epilepsy episode. And these triggers are factors that basically provoke these seizures in persons who have epilepsy, even if they are on medication. Now, it is important to know that the triggers themselves do not cause epilepsy, but they basically increase a person's likelihood of having a seizure. And basically, your brain cells, which we call neurons, they use electrical signals to communicate to one another. Now, in epilepsy, these signals can become abnormally intense, or they can become synchronized, and that leads to a seizure. And then there are certain triggers. So for some people, it's flashing lights. For some people, it can be a certain food. That lowers your brain's seizure threshold. So it makes it easier for this electrical in your brain. That is the easiest way that I can explain it. So the same way that pain medications lower your pain threshold is the same way that these triggers lower your seizure threshold. So it's easier now for your brain to have this malfunction in the neurons and for seizures to occur. Does that make sense?
All right, interesting. Hello, good afternoon.
Hello?
Yes, good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon. Good afternoon, doctor. What I wanted to find out is I have these headaches right on my forehead, like above my eyebrow. I haven't had it all up to last night. So I don't know what I should worry about it, or that's just a normal headache. Thanks.
All right, headaches above the eyebrows.
So headaches on the foreheads, I would say that they're very common, and they do have several causes. Remember that we're talking about primary headaches versus secondary headaches. The primary headaches are the ones that occur without any sort of prompt. For example, no sort of disease is causing it, no sort of tumor is causing it. And tension type headaches are actually the most common cause of forehead pain. So people will experience this dull pressing or tight pain, usually on the forehead or the scalp itself, but they're not going to get any other symptoms, like no nausea, no sensitivity to light, no sensitivity to sound, nothing like that. And the most common triggers that we do see for that would be things like stress or fatigue, or you're straining your eyes watching the screen, or even if you've had poor posture. And the reliefs for that that we would usually recommend, usually over-the-counter pain medications are very much sufficient. If you find that you're stressed out, then stress management techniques, exercise, massage, deep breathing, all of these things do help to reduce your likelihood of getting these headaches. And of course, taking breaks from the screens as well. You should be looking away at this, looking away from your screen for 20 seconds at least. Every 20 minutes you're looking at the screen, and having or applying like a warm compress to relax your forehead muscles will also help as well.
Relax your forehead muscles. How do we do that?
Yes. So essentially, if you have pain somewhere within the body, what you want to do is relax the tension. For example, if it's a muscle pain in your lower back, or even if it's on your head, sometimes it's caused by tension buildup within the muscles or contraction of the muscles that you cannot easily remove. So what's going to happen when you apply heat to the forehead or the lower back or anywhere that you're experiencing pain is that is going to stimulate the blood vessels to provide more blood within that area. And that is going to provide some sort of relief and relaxation, and it will relax the muscles a lot easier than without that heat being applied.
All right, very interesting. Now, as we continue, 625-2257 and 627-3223, it is the lunchtime, Doctor. We have about 12 minutes with you again before we conclude, of course, on our sister stations as well. And Sangeet, we also have the Lunchtime Doctor and Vibe. Everybody is listening and locked in. So with that being said, let's talk about tummy aches. I got a message that my stomach would hurt me from time to time, but the doctor says there's nothing there. CT scan, x-ray, and what you call this thing? When you go to do for babies, ultrasound.
Ultrasound. Mm-hmm.
But they get these stomach cramps. What could be causing that?
Sometimes there's something called functional abdominal pain, or pain that is linked to invisible factors that we cannot see. So some people may just have gut sensitivity, or they may just have stress or digestion issues. Now, when somebody is experiencing I would say stomach pains or abdominal pains, and they may be experiencing other symptoms like constipation or diarrhea, and we would do all these tests, we would do all these imagings, we'll do all these blood tests, we would even do stool tests to find out what is wrong, and we may find nothing at all. And the most common diagnosis we would give these persons would be something like irritable bowel syndrome. And that is actually very common, and it causes chronic abdominal pain in a person. That person may experience bloating, they may experience gas, they may experience, again, the changes in the bowel habits like the constipation or the diarrhea, but there's no structural abnormality that is seen on scans or labs. And it just is triggered by stress or certain food sensitivities or even an imbalance in your gut. And this is what we would usually call a diagnosis of exclusion, meaning that we have to run every single test, we have to run every single scan. We have to run every single stool test before giving a person this irritable bowel syndrome diagnosis. And the management really for this, we would usually tell persons, have a high fiber diet, take your probiotics, and of course, stress reduction as well. Some people may just have functional abdominal pain. Again, another diagnosis of exclusion, meaning that pain is occurring without any sort of clear physical cause. And that will often be in the stressed out adults or persons with anxiety issues as well. And that just makes the gut more hypersensitive to normal sensations. And that is usually linked again to anxiety disorders.
All right. All right. Coming from Sky 99.5, our sister station, what causes floaters passing in front of your eyes? I don't understand that question. What causes floaters passing in front?
This is a very common phenomenon. So I'm sure that you may have actually experienced this already, Davey, because a lot of people do experience it. So they are these small specks or the cobwebs or these shadowy shapes seem to drift across your vision. And especially if you're looking at like a very bright background, like the sky or the white walls or something like that, you will find like these little shapes that are not there, but they are just passing across your vision. And they are usually very harmless. And we would usually see floaters with age-related changes. As we age, this jelly-like substance in the middle of your eye, it tends to shrink and become a little more liquid. So tiny clumps or strands, they start to form and they will cast these shadows. And we would most commonly see it after, say, 40 years of age. But it can also be a sign of something a little more serious, especially if you are starting to see more than usual, or you're starting to see flashes of light. Some people may have a detachment in their eye itself, and it does warrant a medical exam, but sometimes it is harmless. But when people have what we call a retinal tear or detachment, then that becomes very serious. And the warning signs would be like a sudden burst of these new floaters or flashes of light, or you'd find that you have some sort of a curtain or a shadow over your vision, so you're not seeing as you normally would, and you definitely need to get assessment at that point.
All right, no, let's take I thought I had a call. Thank you for that message coming from Sky. Our sister station Vibe as well is on Locked On with us and 95. Hello, good afternoon.
Hello, good day.
Yes.
I have a shoulder injury, a muscular injury. Rolling on the back. My doctor said that is a pinched nerve and I'll have to live with it. The muscular pain has gone. What am I to live with it?
So right. I didn't hear the last part of it, but okay. I heard that they had a pinched nerve.
Yes.
So essentially what happens when you have a pinched nerve in the shoulder area is it would possibly involve your cervical spine or the neck itself, or a plexus of nerves called the brachial plexus, where the nerves sort of exit the spinal cord and travel to your shoulder and your arms. And it can be because maybe you had some sort of muscle injury or spasm, or even just poor posture could cause that, or repetitive strain. Now, the treatment or the management is really just rest and modifying your activities. So you should avoid any sort of heavy lifting. You should use supportive pillows, etc., or roll a towel under the neck while you're sleeping. And of course, ice and heat therapy is also beneficial. You want to switch to heat to loosen any tight muscles, like I said before, and your anti-inflammatory medication, like your NSAIDs, that helps to reduce any pain or swelling. And if it is very severe, like you said, the pain has been gone, then you could also look at physiotherapy as an option, you know, gentle stretches in the neck and the shoulder, that can help to to strengthen the surrounding muscles and improve your posture as well. Some people, like your doctor said, they unfortunately do have to live with it. But over time, with the proper management and the proper protocols, then you will find a lot of relief. Like you said, the pain has gone, but you definitely want to strengthen that area where you've had the pinched nerve so that it does not reoccur.
All right. One message coming in from Sangeet 106.1. We want to say good afternoon to the listeners there as well. Hi, Doc. I have rheumatoid arthritis, but for a couple of days now, I've had a lot of pain in my left side of my head and the left side of my hip. Can the arthritis cause this? What can I do? We have about 4 minutes.
So, yes, the arthritis can cause this, but when we talk about rheumatoid arthritis, we would typically see that the joints or both sides of the body are affected symmetrically, but it could start, a flare could start up on one side, such as the left side of the head and the hip, like this person is saying, especially early in the disease and or during a localized flare-up of itself. You can have rheumatoid arthritis-related joint inflammation in the hip itself. RA can usually affect one side more than the other, especially if it is during a flare. Sometimes it could be referred pain. If one hip or one joint, like the hip, is inflamed, your body may compensate by putting strain on other muscles or joints like the back or the neck, and that is why you're probably experiencing pain in the head itself. But what you definitely need to do, especially if you have rheumatoid arthritis, make sure you're following the protocol that was given to you by the rheumatologist. And especially if you're getting pain, of course you would have been prescribed anti-inflammatory medications like your NSAIDs. If it is very severe, steroid injections are also an option, and you should be taking your DMARD or your biologic medications if you're not already on them. Physiotherapy does help with the joint pain, and like I said, the heat and cold therapy will also be beneficial to you.
Well, with that being said, we want to thank all our listeners. Let me take one very, very quick, squeeze it.
Thank you, my dear. Try about 25 times. Yes, Doc. What is good for constipation and what could help with dizziness?
All right, thank you. Constipation and dizziness. Doc, we have about a minute or less.
So that is going to be a very long topic. But constipation, what can help? Make sure that you're increasing fiber in the diet. Make sure that you are well hydrated on a daily basis. And make sure that you are exercising. We tend to neglect exercise when it comes to our bowel movements, but it is very much beneficial. Dizziness, what helps with dizziness? We have certain maneuvers that help with that. So if you're experiencing something like vertigo, then we have to get down to the root cause, because vertigo is a symptom. It's not a disease. We have to get down to the root cause of why you're experiencing vertigo. And you definitely need to go get it evaluated. There are certain maneuvers that the person, that the doctor can perform that will help to realign the crystals in your semicircular canal. Or if it is due to something else, there are certain medications that you can be put on.
All right. Thank you very much, Doc.
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.